Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. For those of you who have been coming back every week, you know I really appreciate you, and I welcome you back. Those of you who may be listening for the first time, welcome to the show. Today, we are going to have an icon in the war to keep public education public and to fight against those who want to privatize public education. Her name is Dr. Lois Wiener. She is a professor of education at New Jersey City University, where she coordinates a master's degree program in urban education for experienced teachers, not newbies, but experienced teachers. She has published widely on urban education, school reform, teacher unionism, and is a past president of the Special Interest Group on Teachers Work and Teachers Union of the American Education Research Association. She has taught high school for 15 years in California and New York and was an activist in the teachers union while she was teaching. Currently, she is a member of the new public editorial board and maintains a website with information about the global project to deprofessionalize teaching. She is also, she's associated with, don't laugh at me, she's associated with a group called Teachers Unite.
I sure am. I'm on the board of directors.
You're still on the board of directors?
I sure am.
All right. Now, with that, she's just introduced herself, Professor Wiener. Oh, and by the way, she told me I can call her Lois maybe three times during the show. Other than
absolutely.
That.
I'd like phoners to do, anybody who calls in to do the same.
Oh, so they can call in and call you Lois, but I can
absolutely
call you Lois three times.
Absolutely. We're all colleagues. I prefer Lois.
Times.
What?
I three times. Okay. All right. I'll be careful how I use my three times. With that, she has just introduced herself. Welcome, Lois, and I am so thrilled having you on the show. She is
I'm glad
icon.
To be here.
She is an icon, a real icon. She has been in this war a long time, and she has made some terrific contribution on our side of the war. And I want to start off and let her just tell you what she does. She has a new book. Well, a book was published in 2012, and it's called The Future of Our Schools. Lois, let's start there.
Let me just say that the new book follows up from research that I did in editing a book with Mary Compton, who's the past president of the largest teachers union in Europe, the National Union of Teachers in the UK. And that book was the Global Assault on Teaching Teachers and Their Unions, Stories for Resistance. And if anybody really wants to know the research on the global picture, I recommend that book to them. And just let me talk about how I really got started on this. When I became a researcher, when I left the K-12 classroom and became a teacher educator, my specialty was urban teacher education. And I was really involved in that as a researcher for close to 15 years. But at the same time, I kept on my hat as a researcher about teachers' union and teachers' work, and was was chairing a panel at the American Educational Research Association. I think it was 2005, long time ago. And in this panel, I heard about a report that was circulating the World Bank. And somebody said that this report called teachers and teachers' unions the greatest threat to global prosperity. And I was stunned to hear that. And we turned to one of the panelists, who was a past president of the Education International, the International Confederation of Teachers, and she acknowledged that such a report existed and that the World Bank, the president of the World Bank, at that time James Wolfensohn, said, oh, well, that's not really our policy. You know, these two researchers who don't represent anybody wrote this report. And then I turned to the panelist from Mexico, a researcher who does a lot of work with the Mexican Teachers Union, and he said, on the contrary, he said, in our experience, that is the policy of the World Bank, and we're really feeling it in Mexico. So I tried to get a hold of that draft report. I tried to get a hold of the report through official channels, and nobody would send me the report. They didn't answer my emails. And I can be a pretty persistent gal. So I didn't, I followed it up with phone calls and with emails. And I could not get anybody in an official capacity to send me the report. So, you know, the World Bank is pledged to transparency. And the documents for all of the consultations that lead to their final reports are supposed to be on their website. And I spent a summer, an entire summer, June and July, going on that website of the World Bank, and it's massive. It's really a massive repository. And I finally located the draft report. And when I read the draft report, my teeth almost fell out of my mouth because I suddenly was able to put together what was going on in this country with No Child Left Behind and the World Bank. Because this document, this draft report, laid out, it absolutely laid bare the assault on teachers and teachers' unions. It said teachers and teachers' unions are overpaid. They use their political influence to capture governments. In capturing governments, they keep money from going to the schools and to kids who really need them. They're barriers to making progress. They're barriers to alleviating poverty. And therefore, we have to eliminate their strengths. So, and I describe this in my chapter in the book that Mary and I co-edited. But that draft report started me on the road to the research that I've been doing since 2005, which has been documenting how what goes on in the United States reiterates or adapts policies that we see elsewhere in the world. And I said at a conference a few years ago in London, I said, you know, every country in the world is experiencing these policies. They're being introduced everywhere. And Stephen Ball, a researcher I really respect, came up to me privately and he said, Lois, I have to correct you. It's not every country in the world. It's not Finland or North Korea. So there we go. It's not Finland or North Korea, but it's every other country in the world is experiencing an iteration of these policies. Now, that doesn't mean that the policies are equally advanced in every single country. It doesn't mean that the policies are exactly the same. But they're adapted. But the contour of the project is absolutely, absolutely the same. The UK has what's called free schools and academies, and those are our charter schools. They have vouchers have been introduced in almost every country. They are something that in the United States now called the Urban Portfolio Project. And what that's all about is privatizing all school services and having a central authority contract out, just decide what private company is going to manage that particular service. And recently, Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, spoke to the Charter Schools Association in California, and he laid out the plan to get rid of school boards, elected school boards. They're an impediment. Why are they an impediment? Because this project, and it was announced in a Merrill Lynch report, we have the exact citation in the book. It was 1999. So, I'll just say the investment community has known about this for two decades. This is not a conspiracy, because conspiracies are secret. This isn't secret. This is quite public. But we don't hear about it in our mass media, and we don't hear about it in even in the liberal press, magazines, progressive magazines that one would have thought would have known about this. People are really ignorant. They're ignorant about what's going on in education, and people who should know better don't. And they believe the rhetoric. So, when the Merrill Lynch issues a report in 1999 that says, here's the new mindset. Schools are retail outlets, and school boards are customer service departments that answer customer complaints. And who are the customers? Parents. So that's the new mindset that they're using to transform public education. And if you think about schools are retail outlets, what are teachers? Well, teachers are Walmart's associates. We're just selling the goods that they tell us to peddle. We don't have any autonomy or control. Walmart's associates don't have any say about what they sell. They sell what they're told. And how are stores controlled? Well, stores are going to be controlled the same way that stores are. Stores have inventory reports that are computerized. So we don't have inventory reports. What we have is standardized test scores. So it's exactly the same model. It's quite chilling, and it's quite shocking for people in the United States, I think, who send their kids to school and trust that the school and the people in the school are responsible for the kids' well-being. But in fact, teachers no longer have the power to protect kids. I mean, that to me is what's... I think that has to be our main message to parents, is that the schools are really being run by the same people who run multinational corporations. They're not really being run by your local school board. Not when these standardized tests are controlling what's taught and what's on the standardized test, we have no say about.
You have hit almost everything that we have talked about on the show the first 5 weeks of the show. It was as if I was paying you to deliver what you just delivered, going back from what the purpose of education should be. I've dwelled on the role of corporate or business elites trying to take over Bailey about the role of No Child Left Behind and opening the door to privatization, as I see it or saw it at the time and now, that No Child Left Behind basically was a Trojan horse. Hidden inside was the lever to open the door to privatization, and they have traveled through that door like gangbusters. Everything that you've talked about, oh, and also one of the, I think the very first show, I laid out what our purpose was here on the show, and that was to create awareness, because there was no awareness among the general public about what was going on today in America's public education system. And to move from a position of awareness to hopefully a position of understanding. And once they get a position, the public gets a position of understanding, hopefully that would create some type of emotion, some type of value response that would be in our direction, in our favor. By that I mean you and I and the rest of us who are trying to resist the corporatization of American public education, and that they will hopefully join in our side of the war to stop the privatizers. And
yeah, let me hop in here, James, and say something that I usually try to say before I even talk about this World Bank stuff. The rhetoric that's being used to sell this all over the world is that the present state of education, of schooling, doesn't serve all kids. And your mention of No Child Left Behind, you know, sparked my memory about this very important point that I think we always need to recognize, that their rhetoric would not have the impact that it does if we had a system of schooling that really did serve all kids well. But this country has never had that type of education. Not all kids have been equally well served by schools. And I think it's important for those of us who recognize, who are aware of this assault and the way that the rhetoric is being used to further policies that actually make inequality worse. It's very important for us to say that there were serious problems in the way that schools operated before these policies were put in place. And I know that you are aware of all the research that people have done about things like ability grouping, so-called ability grouping in schools, the disproportionate representation of poor kids of color, working class kids of color, in special education, the disproportionate representation of minority males in disciplinary procedures, the lack of access to kids in many schools to critical thinking. And those are all problems that we have to address. But the reforms that are being pushed by Obama and that were pushed before him by Bush are not addressing those problems. What they're doing is making those problems far worse. They're intensifying the problems by creating a dog-eat-dog situation where schools are competing against one another and kids are competing against one another for scarce resources.
So, teachers are competing.
And teachers are competing against one another for scarce resources. So what we need to do is we need to provide all schools with quality support, quality funding, and we need to support teachers and school people to do their jobs well. I think that, you know, a big part of this, the children who were supposed to be addressed by NCLB were primarily poor kids of color. And one of the things that confused many people about No Child Left Behind, aside from the rhetoric, one thing that confused people was, for instance, the requirement that schools report test scores disaggregated by race. And, you know, I did research on the New York City schools, actually, because I was very concerned about my daughter's school. My daughter attended New York City Public Schools. And I did research on her school district, and I was very frustrated that I could not get test scores disaggregated by race. I couldn't, the data wasn't there, because it was New York State and New York City didn't release data disaggregated by race. And so what that meant is that the school system was really able to do a sleight of hand about achievement by touting a school in Lower Manhattan, which everybody who lived in Lower Manhattan, and most people who lived in New Hampshire, parents knew that the reason that school had such high test scores consistently is that it had the wealthiest zip code in the city. The wealthiest zip code. Now, you know, Martin Haberman used to say that schools should have a sign up: we educate best the kids who need us the least. That's who we educate best. And there's a more than a grain of truth to that in city schools. That it's easier to educate kids. It's easy to educate kids. Pretty easy to educate kids. Who come to school with an intact family, who are the children of parents who are well-educated themselves, where there's not financial stress, where the kids don't face racism, they don't face anti-immigrant sentiment, they don't face the stress of insecure employment, parents being in jobs, you know, that are not well paid and that are insecure. They have a home, they have a place to live, they have a warm bed, they have food to eat. You know, we know how to schools educate kids like that very well. The challenge is for us to educate kids who don't come to school that way. And we haven't done it as well as we should. And we have to say that, I think we have to say that up front. We haven't done that as well as we should. But these changes that are being made now are not being made with the intention of improving how we do that. These changes are being made to make money for a small group of people who are already wealthy and to control what is taught and how it is taught. So, you know, two things are true simultaneously, I think. One is that schools in this country haven't done the job that we should have done, and at the same time, that this assault is going to destroy what little progress we have made in doing that job better.
Well, to the listening audience, you can see why I love this lady. She and I are so much on the same page. Even though she won't allow me to call her Lois three times on the show,
as many times as you want, James.
Hey, see, I just scored a victory. Cool for me. We're going to take a break and come back in about a minute and a half. Hang in there. We'll be right back. Okay, we are back. Lois, I want to make a quick announcement. May is Teacher Appreciation Month. Not an official government announcement, but basically it's considered by many of us to be the month that we show our appreciation to teachers. This show and all the shows that we're going to do during the month of May dedicated to teachers. This is their month, and so we're going to spend the entire month trying to show them our appreciation by bringing out what we know about this war on public education, the who, the what, the why, the when, the casualties, and et cetera, what teachers and others are doing to resist and fight back. This is going to be their month. And so with that, I'm going to turn to your book, Lois, The Future of Our Schools, because it's really right on point in terms of showing tremendous appreciation for teachers. So,
great.
It's going to be your show, pretty much.
But
I'm going to start off with one question, and that is, why did you choose the title that you did? Is there a
The Future of Our Schools?
Yeah.
Well,
is there a meaning there?
I have to thank the publisher, actually, for the title. And the people at Haymarket who came up with the title are not teachers. And so I thought that they had a terrific insight about the message of the book in choosing that title. Because the message of the book is that despite all of their problems, and they have many problems, if we don't transform teachers' unions and make them live up to their potential, we're not going to be able to win this war. We're not going to be able to turn back this attack on public education. And it's so the struggle to transform the teachers' unions and turn them around is, I really think, the key factor in strategically in our capacity to turn back this assault on public education. The reason for that goes back to what I was talking about in the other half of the show, which is the reasons that teachers' unions have been targeted. I mean, it's hard to pick up a paper or watch TV or listen to the radio without seeing a story about bad teachers. And it's important to realize that all this rhetoric about bad teachers and the fact that the unions defend bad teachers is all this trashing of teachers is a way to weaken teachers' professional authority and also to weaken the teachers' unions. So why do rich, powerful elites want to weaken teachers' unions? Because they realize better than most teachers do that the unions have enormous potential. They have power that advocacy groups do not have, that social justice groups do not have. The unions are stable. They have institutional roots. That's one reason that collective bargaining is attacked, because collective bargaining gives teachers a voice legally to have something to say about what goes on in the schools. It plants the seeds of democracy in the school. After all, teachers and parents never elect a principal. Teachers and parents never elect a superintendent. But teachers do elect the person in the school who represents them, the building representative or the chapter leader, the person is sometimes called, and teachers do elect union officers. So that dynamic of members controlling what occurs is conflicts with the hierarchical and the paternalistic relationships in school districts. And although by itself it is not enough, because while the union gives teachers voice, it does not automatically give parents and students voice. And so the unions really need to be transformed fast so that they realize that they have to speak on behalf of social justice and that they have to be owned by their members. Teachers have to stop waiting for the union to do something. And they have to realize that they are the union. You can't wait for the union to come and take care of a problem when a program is cut that kids need because a principal has made a decision that he or she is going to spend the money on, I don't know, computers or new materials. What teachers need to do is they need to organize at the school site with parents and with students who are affected by those policies, affected by those cuts. They can't wait for the union to do it. They have to organize themselves and draw on the union resources and demand that the union help them in the struggle. So the power of the union has to start in the school with teachers who feel confident and who are not afraid to stand up for what's right. So I think this is happening throughout the country. This process is happening throughout the country. Yesterday, I was the keynote speaker at this wonderful conference in Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia schools are just being decimated by the politicians. And, you know, one of the things that I talked about in my keynote, in my speech, it was a great, great, really lively, so energetic and so hopeful. You know, so different from the energy that one sees in schools today because teachers are so demoralized and kids are so worn out and bored and tired and stressed by the, you know, the culture of testing. So one of the things that I talked about was this insight that I had when I went to the American Educational Research Association and I heard all of these presentations by researchers on the Philadelphia schools and its budget crisis. And one researcher after another stood up and, you know, showed these graphs and showed these charts that talked about the budget problem. And every single one noted one of the school district's obligations was debt service. And because of all the obligations, the school system is going to have to, the researcher said, make hard decisions and either close schools and cut teachers or dip into the pension funds. Okay. Now, this is the issue for me. What is debt service? Debt service is interest that the school district owes to banks. That's what debt service is. The school district borrowed money, and it owes interest to the banks. Well, why is interest to the banks inviolable, sacrosanct, and pension funds can be cut? The pension funds were a contract, a legal contract, and yet it's okay to violate that contract, but it's not okay to say to the banks, we need to renegotiate this debt. We can't afford to pay you. So the banks and the corporations are holding the kids and the teachers and the community hostage. That's what's going on here. And it's up to the union. It's up to the teachers' union to say that. It's up to the teachers' union to say these are the same banks who have engaged in predatory loaning. that has ravaged communities of color and working class communities. These are the same banks that charge, when they can, usurious rates on credit cards to people who can't afford it. And now they are also taking money from our kids, forcing us to close schools. No way. No way. So, you know, after the conference, and after my keynote, I met with these terrific young teachers, mostly young teachers, who have formed a caucus, a reform caucus, Caucus of Education Workers, in the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. And they said, you know, we're taking this message to the schools, and people are shocked. It's an entirely different way of thinking about the union. It's an entirely different way of thinking about the union. It's not a matter that the union is a business.
I'm going to stop you on that point, because that takes me to the next point that I wanted to make before our time runs out.
Okay.
From your book, The Future of Our Schools, to me, there were several messages that were there loud and clear. One, you were arguing that we need to transform the unions to be more involved in community, building coalitions, and taking on social issues that affect many, many hundreds, thousands of people, and bringing those people into a movement that will go after the privatization of public education, as well as going after inequality, poverty, and et cetera. That was one of the messages that I got, was that
yes,
we need to transform our union. And I totally got the unions have so much potential that they don't even know and are not utilizing effectively. And from that point, it leads me to a question, and I don't know whether or not you're going to hang up on me when I raise this, when I make a statement, basically.
Yeah. I think I know what's coming.
I knew it. Okay.
Okay.
It sounds to me, what you're saying is that the future of schools depend upon teachers' unions being transformed, and in that transformation, becoming more of a force that aims at the bigger picture.
Mm.
And that bigger picture being working to create a better world, one that is more just, equitable, sustainable, peaceful.
Right.
That comes out of my lifetime work. I've been writing something on that, using those exact words, creating a better world. But what you were expecting, and here it comes, it sounds like to me what you're advocating comes very close to what a guy by the name of George C. Counts advocated back in 1932 in a book that was published called Dare Our Teachers, actually it was a Dare the Schools, build
right.
a new social order. I'm saying that you're saying dare our teachers union defend and save public schools through a social movement unionism.
Right.
And so, now, with that, I'm going to ask you to hang on, because I need to talk about two or three things as we're running out of time. One, I'm hopefully come May the 25th, our guest today will return, and she will be at a conference in London, England, and we are working to put together a show from London, England, with her as a co-host, and she will hopefully bring other teachers, other leaders to discuss what is happening in this war on public education from a global perspective. If we can pull this off, I think it will be the first time an American story has been told about the real globalization nature of globalized nature of this war. I don't know of any other television, news program, blogger, et cetera, that have really put out a in-depth discussion of the global nature of this war. So hopefully we'll be breaking new grounds. Also, next week, Sunday the 11th, is Mother's Day. And I was advised that one should never do a program on Mother's Day. Well, I wrestled with this all week, and I decided about an hour before the show, we're going to do a special show on Mother's Day. And the show is going to be called The First Teacher. Our mothers are usually our first teacher. We're going to celebrate all the first teachers. It's going to be unscripted. I'm hoping that I can get the word out. Maybe Lois can help me get the word out so that students will call in and talk about their mothers as their first teachers. Mothers will call in and talk about their grandmother, their mothers, as their first teacher. I would love if Lois is available, she can call in and give us 5 minutes to talk about that. She's a parent, she's a mother, she was her children's first teacher, I bet you. And so I'm going to go against conventional wisdom and do a show that's dedicated to our mothers and grandmothers, our first teachers. Next, as I sort of mentioned earlier, this whole month is going to be dedicated to teachers. And there are many reasons to do such a dedication, but there's one thing that, again, our general public is not aware of. We're aware that the month of May is usually the end of the school year, sometimes going into the 1st of June. What the public doesn't know is that the end of the school year, sometimes, and often nowadays, is also the end of our teacher's career. And this is as a result of the war on public education. Part of that war is to take out teachers. Teachers represent the greatest challenge to the privatizers, corporate elites who want to take over public education, their greatest threat, and followed by their unions, of course. And so there is a concerted design effort to take out teachers in many different ways that they can come up with. And so for some teachers, this month may be their last as a teacher, unless they can find employment someplace else. And so that's another reason why the show is going to be dedicated to teachers. And I hope as many teachers as we can get to become aware of this dedication to them and that they will listen and get others to listen so that those teachers, even though they may not be employed as teachers, could still be active members in the movement that Lois and I and others are trying to get going to take on the privatizers. So, in that spirit, after next Sunday's show, on the 18th, Julian will be back, Dr. Heilig will be back, and he and I are going to do an in-depth report on Teach for America. We're going to do two shows on Teach for America. And Teach for America represents one of the greatest threats to the teaching profession. And they are the reason why many school districts feel that it's okay to get rid of experienced teachers, certified teachers, because they know they have waiting in the wing a group of inexperienced, less trained but cheaper labor force to come in.
Right.
And run.
That's not going to stay, they think.
Right. They never, you know, they'll never say that, but that's what's happening. So Julie and I will do two shows on that. And now I'm going to go into a show that would be hopefully June 1st, and I'm going to tell a story, and then you'll find out what that show will be about. Last Sunday night, I got an email, along with probably thousands of other people, that Dr. Mercedes Snyder, her new book was finally available for purchase. Her new book is called A Chronicle of Echoes, Who's Who, and the Implosion of American Public Schools. We were all elated. I immediately ordered the book, wrote a comment on her comment section on her blog. I think I was the fifth or sixth person to do that. That was really early in the game. Well, 2 days later, I think it was 2 days later, another book came out by a guy by the name of Paul Peterson. And his book, it was titled something totally different. His book was called Teachers Versus the Public, What Americans Think About Schools and How to Fix Them. We have two books to come out within 2 days of each other, taking different sides of the war and the history of the two books and how they were published and now how they are being marketed represent a tale of almost two cities in analogy. Mercedes' book is being published without any promotion, without any fanfare. She doesn't have a Kindle edition yet for her book. She doesn't have an interactive book image yet on Amazon. She doesn't have a marketing department. Whereas Paul Peterson is a corporate published sort of book. He has all of those things. He has a big marketing budget. He has a marketing department pushing his book, Kindle edition, you name it. Guess what, folks? Even with the lack of all the corporate money that Paul has, Mercedes' book is kicking his ass. As of last night, she sent an email out last night, and she let us all know that her book was rated in the top 3% of all books on Amazon in less than a week. Her book was ranked 5,194th. Paul Peterson's book, on the other hand, with all of its power behind it, and his book was endorsed by Jeb Bush and Michelle Rhee. His book was ranked 128,000 on the list. Listen to what I just said.
Yeah, right.
Top 3% on one book and ranked 5,194 versus Peterson's book at 128,053. Diane Ravitch, she sent out a blog, I think it was yesterday as well, where she made some comments, and basically what she said was that Paul's book, which was designed to tell the public that teachers are the scum of the earth, basically, those are not her words. She would never do that. Mm-hmm. These are my words. I will do it all the time. And so she was very kind, but she also was very emphatic about Mercedes' book was really, really taking off. And it's all because of word of mouth, us talking about it through social media. And so that in the end, it may be that the public like teachers a lot more than Paul Peterson thinks and want to believe.
Right.
And that teachers are not public enemy number one, like Paul tends to think. So, folks, I want you to buy her book. She, by the way, will be on the show June 1st. We will be talking about her book. And she hopefully will be back later during the summer to talk about Common Core. And if we do the Common Core thing, it'll be at least 3 weeks episode. And my final thing, announcement. For those of you who were with us last week, I did a dedication and then a tribute to one Deborah Emerson, the voice that you hear introducing the show. And I was lamenting the fact that she was no longer with BBS and hence no longer with the show. Well, Deborah went to the archives the beginning of this past week, and she listened to our show. She called me, and this is pretty much what she had to say to me. And it was basically, you suck at tribute, giving a tribute. Your tribute was all about you. Tributes are supposed to be about the person that you are talking about, not yourself. You really suck at tribute. You didn't say such things as Deborah was the greatest of ever. And most importantly, you didn't say how behind every mediocre, so-so radio host, there is a great woman, duh, like me, Deborah. And she went on and on and on. Deborah, I apologize. I didn't give you all the accolades that I did talk about myself. I'm lying, folks. Deborah is back with the War Report. And I am so happy. But I had to do that little lie just to get back at her. She is responsible for helping me get Lois on the show. She's responsible for Dr. Mercedes Snyder coming on the show. She's also responsible for Julian coming back next week. She is terrific. The show is going to be better each week because of her. And I hope she's not mad at me for doing my satire with announcing her return. I was going to come on by saying, she's back, in reference to a famous phrase coming from a horror movie. So anyway, Deborah, welcome back. And we love you on the show. And with that, I will say goodbye because I know I've gone over my time. Thanks, BBS, for letting me have the extra few minutes. Folks, come back next week for the special First Teacher Mother's Day show. Lois, thank you so deeply. And I look forward to us being able to make some history here and having you report from London in a couple of weeks.
Okay, that sounds great, James. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. And Deborah, welcome back, and good evening to you, too. Goodbye.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.